In popular culture, Iowa is often depicted as nothing but a flatland. But is it really?
It's got a very subtle and rolling beauty to it. A lot of people think that it's flat in Iowa, and it's absolutely not flat here.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Not so flat after all. It's Iowa Week, and we're looking at unexpected aspects of our state. This hour, we explore Iowa's landscape in popular culture and give it a reality check. Before that, we learn the unexpected and critical role supposedly flat Iowa played in downhill ski history. Can you describe Iowa's landscape in five words or less without using the word flat? Join the conversation after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. All this week, we are breaking from our usual approach of news-based discussions on River to River to bring you Iowa Week, both on this program and on Talk of Iowa, with a focus all this week on unexpected things in our state, unexpected aspects of our state. This hour, we immerse ourselves in Iowa's landscape and inspire our discussions with the slogan, "Not so flat after all." Later in the hour, we look at Iowa's landscape in popular culture and give it a reality check. We want to have you help us out. Can you describe Iowa's landscape in five words or less without using the word flat? That's the overused word we want to avoid. Iowa's landscape in five words or less without using the word flat. Why don't you go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page to put that up? You can tweet us at IPR Talk or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Well, as a way to prime the pump, let's listen to some Iowans who producer Lindsay Moon caught up with recently and quizzed about the flatness of our state.
If you were going to describe what the land looks like, what would you say?
Cornfields, agriculture, and that's it.
It's exactly what you picture when you think of Iowa, cornfields and things like that around. It's just like what you picture small town Midwest to look like.
I mean, you're going to see a lot of crops, but it's not completely flat land. There's some rolling hills for sure, depending on where you go.
You drive through, it's a lot of farms, but it's still very pretty. It is flat. It is kind of boring, but it's beautiful.
It's got a very subtle and rolling beauty to it. A lot of people think that it's flat in Iowa, and it's absolutely not flat here.
Where do you think that idea comes from?
Just the general depiction of, you know, of Iowa as being, you know, the bread belt, the corn belt of America, and it's depicted as being very flat. And a lot of people drive through here on the way to somewhere, but my feeling is it's surely not as flat as Nebraska.
It's colorful, rolling hills, plains, it's gorgeous.
If someone were to say, well, Iowa, it's nothing but flat farmland and lots of cornfields, and that's all it is, what would you say to that?
They've either never been here or they only love the mountains.
Why do you think the state gets a rap for being nothing but flattened cornland?
Probably because you got to drive through Nebraska to get here.
People's perception of it is just being like kind of like podunk country state, I guess. Like we're all just farmers to their point of view.
And that's not true?
No, not true at all.
So when Iowa is depicted as nothing but a cornfield, how do you guys feel about that?
I feel like it makes other people think, like, why would anyone want to live here? Why would anyone come here? When I think the people who live here love it.
A few of the Iowans commenting on Iowa's landscape. Lindsay Moon collected those, and it's our challenge to you. Five words or less describe Iowa's landscape without using the word flat. And go to our Facebook page, tweet us at IPR Talk, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org is our email. We'll get to that in the second half hour, giving Iowa's landscape in popular culture a reality check. See how the match is there. Before that, we learn the unexpected and critical role supposedly flat Iowa had in downhill ski history. No, no, not cross-country skiing. I said downhill ski history. It turns out that Robert Lang of Dubuque, Iowa, fashioned the first plastic ski boot near one of the tallest hills in the Midwest here in Iowa. Joining us now to talk about that is Tony Lobianco. He has been a ski school director. He has been a ski school director at Sundown Mountain in Iowa for 39 years. Tony, are you there?
I am. How are you today?
I am fine. So 39 years, you're almost up to 40 years. Let's want to definitely talk about sundown as a phenomenon here in the Midwest for skiers. But let's talk about this ski boot story, first of all. Who would have thought that Iowa had a role in the development of the modern plastic downhill ski boot? Can you tell us that story?
Yes, that was very interesting. You know, a lot of times when people go out to Colorado and go skiing, and they're like, they'll say, you're from Iowa. Well, what do you do there for skiing? And then we always say, have you ever heard of Lang ski boots? And, oh, my God, yes. That revolutionized the whole boot ski boot industry in the world is what it did. And it was about around 1968 when Jean-Claude Keeley, world-famous downhill skier and Olympic-style skier, had visit the Lang people in Dubuque here and actually helped them come up with a little bit of development of this boot. You know, approximately before that, it was all leather-bound boots. And, they weren't, you know, very warm. They weren't very stable. So they went to the Olympics in 68. I'm not sure. I think it was a European country and introduced the Lang plastic boot. And it just took off and revolutionized the whole industry. So right here in Dubuque, Iowa, we were very, very proud of that.
What does that hard plastic do for the skiing experience? What does it allow you to do in a downhill ski that the previous leather boot did not?
Well, the leather boot was very flexible, and it broke down, and it wasn't waterproof. And or plastic boot, the first molded plastic boot, had more stability and was able to, you know, the ski would become more one with your foot rather than your ski flopping around on you. It gave a lot more stability and a lot more control of the ski by far.
Mm-hmm. So the idea with downhill skiing is you want to pretty much, I mean, immobilize from the calf on down that ankle and the foot, right?
Yes, you want to be driving the ski. You don't want the ski taking you for a ride. You want to be in charge of it.
So Lang boots still exist?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Lang boots are very, very big. And I believe they're made out of Colorado now, but they are just huge on the market right now.
Is that patented? What? How can I make sure? Or is any plastic boot a Lang boot? It's not, but are there patented parts that we can look at and look down at our ski boot, perhaps this ski season, and know it's a Lang?
No, Lang's got their name brightly on the side of it. Now, I don't know if they're patented on, you know, all of them, but there are so many great boots, but they were the first one to introduce this that just everybody else jumped in.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great story. I'm sure you share when you go around the country skiing and people say, well, what the heck does Iowa have to do with skiing, huh?
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely.
So let's talk about Sundown Mountain. I think we're reaching you there, aren't we?
Yes. I am in the office right now. And it's a gorgeous day out. And our hills here are just beautiful. It's a very steep hill. We have a 475-foot vertical, which is definitely one of the highest verticals in the Midwest. A lot of people tend to think that Wisconsin and Minnesota is the ski country. And we actually have a higher vertical than most of them. There definitely are higher verticals, you know, way up north. But along the Mississippi River, the hills are really rolling and beautiful.
I've been to your ski mountain a number of times. And I would dare say it's probably a pretty good chance that we've sat on a chairlift next to each other without introducing each other.
Probably have to
ourselves. You've been there for quite a while.
Yes, I have. Yes.
And do we know how that ski valley was formed there in Iowa?
Oh yes, there was 10 owners that got together. They were all skiers from Dubuque here that loved to ski. And they had belonged to a ski club. Actually, there was a ski club in Dubuque here 50 years ago. It was a Snowmad Ski Club. And they had they got back together again. They're doing it again. But they used to take trips up to north, way up by Michigan area, way back before any skiers were really going around here. So the owners, the Dubukers, they decided, let's build ourselves a ski area here. So they went out and found the perfect piece of property. Our hill is right outside of Dubuque, about 15 minutes, and it's got a 150-year-old pine tree forest, juniper trees, and it overlooks the Tyre Valley. It's very, very scenic. We have won an award for design, being a very natural-looking ski area. It's not near Metropolitan or anything. You look out over the hills. ski down through these trees. It's very, very, very pretty. And when they started out, they thought it would be just a small little area that with one chair left in a small building. And skiing really took off in the 80s. We started in 1973 here. And skiing got very, very popular in the Butte area and took off very well. So we expanded into 5 chairs, 2-3 buildings. And we are in the process right now of building a new building out here, which is really, really going to be a very big, nice part of the area that upgraded.
What's that building to serve as?
That'll be serving as main office and ticket windows. It'll be a lot, all state-of-the-art ticket windows that you will be able to approach from the outside with an overhang over it and speed your line up to get on the slope as quick as you can. And then also it'll be a large rental shop in there with the main office, of course. And the rental shop will be state-of-the-art, speed everybody up. You want to get your equipment and get out on the hill. There'll be a tuning shop for tuning your skis. And it'll just open the area up very nicely. And we'll be taking one of our older buildings down, which will be helpless when we have more room at the top of the hill. It's just going to be a huge improvement for us.
If you've just joined us, my guest this half hour is Tony Lobianco. We're looking at unexpected things in Iowa, the unexpected phenomenon known as a sundown mountain, a ski mountain in the Midwest, one of the best in our area. Tony has been ski school director at Sundown for nearly 40 years. I understand also tied in with the history of Sundown, Tony, is that one of the guys, the founders, was he a ski jumper in the Army?
Oh, no, we have one of our ski instructors, Ernie Moreski, and he's going to be 92 years old this year, on Christmas, and he's still teaching skiing with us. And he and my father, Stan Lobianco, they were both in the 10th Mountain Division, Second World War. And that's how I got interested in skiing. Was my dad had all that equipment and had skied over in Europe out in Camp Hale, which is right by Vail, Colorado, where they trained. And my father has passed away now, but Ernie is still with us. And at 92, he's one heck of a great skier.
Wow.
Great guy, really.
Do you ever put on those old bindings from generations ago and just give it a go and see how different it is?
Well, actually, when I started out as a young boy, or about 7 years old, I'm 63 now, I had skis. I had skis like that were real leather bound. And but now I have them just hanging on the wall as ornaments, and they're very beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Okay, 475 feet is the vertical drop. How does that compare with other ski areas in the immediate vicinity, Iowa, of Sundown in northeast Iowa?
We're probably one of the 6th highest verticals. There are a lot of them. They're right around 230, 400, 300. And, of course, there are some that are 600 to 700 in areas up in Wisconsin, way up there in even Lutzen, north of Duluth. That's pretty decent. That's about 1,000 vertical. That's way up along Lake Superior.
Mm-hmm. But go ahead.
We rank pretty high on our vertical. It's decent long runs. Well, you can get up about a half mile or so run. So very unusual for in Iowa. People just don't realize how beautiful the rolling hills are here.
Oh, they really are. Now, you travel around the country, I understand.
I have skied in several places. Not recently. I've gone up to Lutzen quite a bit. I've been through Colorado, to Vermont, and Lake Tahoe area. I've skied in those places.
And you run into people still today? Well, constantly, I imagine, because you say you're from Iowa, you're a ski instructor from Iowa. Does that get a few chuckles from time to time?
Not some areas it does, but actually we have several ski instructors that went through the whole school here and have moved out, you know, in the wintertime and teach skiing at Vail. So Vail, Colorado is very... knows our area pretty well. They hear the school knows us because we've got about, I bet there's 10 or 12 ski instructors from this area that are actually teaching in Vail right now.
Mm-hmm. So is Sundown a good place to learn how to ski? Certainly the fundamentals there.
Absolutely. We have about 95 ski instructors, and we teach all levels of skiing and snowboarding. And we have race teams. We have a very fantastic children's program here for the kids that are 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 year olds.
Mm-hmm. Now, Now, when you talk about kids, last few years that I've been skiing at Sundown and other places, I noticed that snowboarding has really taken off.
Yes, it did.
And years ago, that was when that entered the scene, that was almost, it was a little bit resented. Is that too much? It was a little bit of a rebellious thing for a young person to do.
It was somewhat, yeah. Skiing slowed down a little bit, you know, for a while there, and then it was at a zero growth, and then the snowboarding came back in. Really gave it a boost, which is, you know, but, you know, the snowboard first development of it, it wasn't a real stable board. It had a tendency to slide a little bit more. But through technology, they've improved the snowboard very, very much. And the board has good control now, much, much better control when it first started out. I think that might have been the big part when it first came out. You know, there wasn't as much control on it as there is now.
Mm-hmm. Now skiing and snowboarding are two completely different things. I know this firsthand, Tody, having tried, and I was warned beforehand, you know, having been a skier, they said, you know, count your first day on your snowboard. It's not one you might not enjoy very much, but you've got to learn it. You've got to go through it. And I did, and I found it very, very difficult. Why? How is snowboarding different than skiing?
Snowboarding balances a little different. Now, I don't snowboard. I'm just a solid skier. I love it. And when snowboarding, the learning curve is a little slower. Once you get to the point of where your balance is there and you use your front edge and back edge, it snaps in pretty quick that you start getting along real well. But it's just that the learning curve is a little bit longer. On skiing, with your legs being independent, where snowboards are attached to the board together, and skis, you're independent. In one lesson, an hour and a half lesson, you can accomplish, you know, great stopping, turning, ride the lifts, you know, hopefully getting down the longer beginner hill. And that's not always the case in snowboarding. So the snowboarding usually takes a little bit longer to get to the point where you're in better control.
Are there slopes, moguls perhaps, that are better suited for skiing than snowboarding?
Yes, moguls are definitely for skiers. You'll see snowboarders try and get in those, but it's a little difficult with and moguls snowboarders.
You have a fabulous terrain park there, or even two, don't you?
Yes, we have two terrain parks here. That is just really a fantastic thing for younger kids, which I say younger kids who are snowboarding, most of them. And now, surprisingly, there's older groups of people that are into snowboarding now. And I see parents coming back and wanting to learn a snowboard because their kids do.
Yeah. For those who've never seen it or experienced it, describe what goes on in a terrain park. I guess we can look at the Olympics and see a lot of it, can't we?
Yeah, Olympics, it's very similar. We're a little bit smaller scale. They have some huge jumps. Our jumps we put in are very big. There's rails, ride on a rail. They have boxes, flat boxes you go off. They call tabletops. Just a lot of different terrain stuff that you can do tricks on and ride on.
Mm-hmm. And a big question there, I think, especially for parents, is do terrain parks and snowboards offer a greater hazard than traditional skiing?
Well, no, they're just, you have to be respectful of them. They have to learn the ropes, learn how to control themselves better. That's the whole thing.
What other activities are going on at Sundown Mountain?
Well, we have the junior race team, which is a fantastic race team, five-year-olds on up, and our race team is very large, and there's several race teams in the Midwest that compete together. They're called Wajara. It's Wisconsin, Illinois, different ski areas, and they go from area to area each weekend and compete. It's getting to be very big. I think we're pushing probably about, 60 or 70, 65 kids, I think, that are on it.
Did you say down to 5 years old?
Yes. Start at 5 years old on up to 18.
Uh-huh. So is that about the earliest you can get them is 5 years old?
Yeah, we start, our children's program starts at 4 years old here, learning how to ski. But the race team, they'll take the kids up, they'll take them at 5 years old. And it's just amazing how these kids, how great the skiers have become on this race team.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. What sense do you get for skiing when you start that early? Do you, I guess you feel just as comfortable on skis as you do in a pair of shoes?
Absolutely. You know, once again, I started when I was, I think I was about six or seven when I started skiing. And I just absolutely loved it. And, it's been a very good sport to stay with. Actually, it is a lifetime sport, which a lot of sports are not. You look at when you go to school, you play baseball. A lot of times you'll have intramural baseball later in life. But a lifetime sport. Families, and it's actually growing into one of the larger retirement sports because people are healthier and they're enjoying skiing, and they start back up again. Some of them have backed off from skiing a little bit because they were raising families. Kids get a little bit bigger, and they say, well, it's time to get back into skiing. So I have on our ski school, I have 49 people that are retired that teach. Ages from 63 to 92. A lot of them are 70s and 80s.
Amazing. Now, in other aspects of Iowa, and particularly in agriculture, we talk a lot about the coming climate change, what is happening, and I imagine that must concern you, though it's not entirely clear what that may mean for our weather, colder or warmer or snowfall. Do you give any thought to that?
Yes, you know, that's been kind of a complicated issue. We hear a lot about global warming. You know, last winter wasn't quite global warming, I think. But
no, I didn't experience it that way either, Tony.
But it's, you know, the weather patterns have always been in history. They flowed up and down. And with the snowmaking facilities, which has really, really taken the ski areas in a positive direction, years ago we would not be able to, you know, ski very well without the snowmaking. Snowmaking now is such a science, and the conditions are on the hills are so beautiful, and the grooming with these new grooming machines, pistol-y, all that.
So it's fair to say that even if we don't get snow, as long as you have those temperatures down far enough, you can have a great season.
Oh, absolutely. We can pound out snow out here so fast to get this place open and running, and it's just amazing how much snow that can be made.
Well, we have September 22nd. What are you looking at as far as an opening date? Do you set it this far ahead, or can you even know?
You know, we always try and open up the day after Thanksgiving. Our season, we like to run from the day after Thanksgiving to St. Patrick's Day, our advertised. And we generally hit that day after Thanksgiving about every year. A couple times we have it. We have warm, unusual November, December, but I know this year we were 50-60% open.
Okay. Tony Lobianco, we have to go. Thank you very much. Ski school director at Sundown Mountain in northeast Iowa for 39 years. Thanks for chatting with us, Tony.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, we look at Iowa's landscape and popular culture and give it a reality check. Is Iowa's landscape really as simple as described in this very short song by Haywood Banks called Interstate 80, Iowa?
Interstate 80, Iowa.
Mississippi River, Davenport.
Corn, 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 corn.
What's that smell?
Corn, 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 Iowa City. Corn, 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 corn.
Look, a tree.
Corn, 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 corn. Corn, 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 corn.
There's that smell again.
Corn, 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 Council Bluffs, Missouri River.
41-second song challenging you this hour when we come back after a short break. Can you describe Iowa's landscape in 5 words or less without using the word flat? 1-866-780-9100. Email us your 5 words or less, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook or tweet us at IPR Talk. Come back. When we come back, we look at Iowa's landscape in popular culture and give it a reality check. It's Iowa Week here on Iowa Public Radio with River to River and Talk of Iowa. All this week, we're departing from our usual approach here on River to River of news-based discussions to bring you Iowa Week with a focus on the unexpected in our state. In this hour, we're immersing ourselves in Iowa's landscape and inspiring our discussions with the slogan, "Not so flat after all." And this half hour, we want to look at Iowa's landscape in popular culture and give it a reality check. And we'd like to have you help us out. Can you describe Iowa's landscape in 5 words or less without using the word flat? Go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, tweet us at IPR Talk, or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. A number of really wonderful ones have come in. Julia tweets us, "Rumpled blankets on a bed." Iowa's landscape. Dan tweets, "Dynamic green and gold home." Joanne, entrepreneurs sprinkled among bountiful fields. And another tweet from R.S. Osman says that hilly earth, woods, lakes, and rivers. Dustin on our Facebook page, Rolling Hills, Beautiful Vistas, Community. And Charity Nebby writes a tweet to us, subtly stunning and modestly breathtaking. Thanks for getting in on the show here, Charity. Want to talk about, keep them coming. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find us on Facebook or write us an email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Joining us now, Anna Haujik, a lecturer in the English department at the University of Wisconsin at Whitewater. Hello, Anna.
Hello. Hi.
I hope I got your last name correct. Haujik?
Haujik, yep.
Haujik. Mm-hmm. Very good. Mm-hmm. Now, you study our cultural ideas about the Midwest, the nostalgia we have for this part of the country. In fact, you wrote a paper published in 2009 in the online Journal of Rural Research and Policy titled, "You Really Ought to Give Iowa a Try, Tourism, Community Identity, and the Impact of Popular Culture in Iowa." Tell us, in America's collective imagination, what is Iowa's landscape?
Well, in America's collective imagination, Iowa's landscape is, unfortunately, as you said earlier, flat. But it is so much more than that. You know, that flat landscape, of course, in America's collective imagination is dominated by corn, dominated by corn and crops and hogs. But at the same time, Iowa's identity has been really fueled by a sort of collective national nostalgia, I would argue, especially in films and in other kinds of cultural productions like The Music Man by Meredith Willson, for example, where the title of the paper comes from a song from The Music Man, like a film like A Field of Dreams, which, of course, Field of Dreams is about an Iowa corn farmer, but it's also about baseball and how baseball and kind of our national collective identity are sort of tied together in that way. And, you know, the nostalgia, I think, is really key here in thinking about the way in which Iowa has also, you know, stood for broader conceptions about our national identity. You know, one conversation I had earlier in the week with your producer, I talked a bit about the Iowa caucuses every, 4 years, mm-hmm. and how those caucuses really stand, you know, they are the early gauge for the nation. And I think in some respects, you know, that will never be taken away from Iowa in terms of the way in which national American identity is so culturally bound up with Iowa as a sort of mythic heartland.
Mm-hmm. In fact, you mentioned the Iowa caucuses. That's one of the things we're going to be touching on Wednesday of this week, our politics day. We'll be looking at the Iowa caucuses as a phenomenon, how that happened, that Iowa, of all places, in an unexpected way, became, I guess you used the word gateway for some of our elections. I'm interested in this word nostalgia that you keep coming back to. So mm-hmm. we have, as you get older, you feel that the world is just changing more and more quickly, and technology and all these things. So nostalgia links into something solid, something that people yearn for, right? And that matches mm-hmm. up with our landscape. Is that what you're saying?
Right, and I think, you know, nostalgia, another way to also put it is our heritage. So, for example, you know, I think the statistic is that most Americans today, the vast majority of Americans are at least two and even three generations removed from agriculture, removed from farming. And I think that that's part of it, that because Iowa is dominated by agriculture, and yet so few Americans actually farm, actually are living on an agricultural lifestyle, that Iowa's agrarian identity is part of that nostalgia. And so nowhere is this more sort of kind of on display than the Iowa State Fair, where, again, you have first a novel, and then a musical, and then a film that have sort of, you know, helped create this piece of popular culture that is so, again, kind of bound up in Iowa's agricultural identity. And I think farming and nostalgia sort of, in a lot of ways, sort of work hand in hand. And because Iowa's sort of fundamental identity, when you just fundamental identity is so linked to farming, that in a way also feeds that nostalgia in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Anna Hajek, stay with us, a lecturer in English at the University of Wisconsin at Whitewater. Stay with us. I want to share some more tweets and emails here. Our five-word challenge, Iowa's landscape in five words or less, not using the word flat. Maureen, rolling hills filled with wholeness. Travis, soft rolling hills, warm people. Mike Butterworth, must be of the Nadas listening. Thanks, Mike. Lush rolling beauty and corn. Jill, the Midwest's best kept secret. Josh, post-glacial north hills south. Thank you very much for joining in with our challenge here. Also joining us, Jane Milosh is a director of the Provenance Research Initiative at the Smithsonian Institute, former curator of the Renwick Gallery of the Smithsonian American Art Museum. Jane, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you for joining us. Tell us, how has Iowa been depicted in art?
Well, I guess probably the most well-known booster for the Iowa landscape is Grant Wood. Most people know it when you strike a pose that looks with a man with a pitchfork and a sour-faced woman, which was his first famous painting.
Right.
But painted in that very same year, in 1930, his second most well-known paintings was Stone City, Iowa, which depicts an amazingly beautiful, rolling, lush landscape with the quarries that were actually in Stone City. So it does everything to defy the notion that Iowa is flat. However, it is very interesting that so many people do think that. Now living in Washington, D.C., I feel like I'm sort of a resident Iowan still here, even though I'm originally from Michigan. I was shocked myself.
You were.
When we arrived, yes, yes.
So the popular culture that you had been taking in Michigan or wherever else you were before that did not entirely match up with what you found as a reality here.
No, not at all, because I think it has to do with the literature and the Depression and the Dirt Bowl scenario. People tend to think of plains and prairies
the Dust Bowl. Yeah, the Dust Bowl rolling down, huh?
Absolutely. Or, a kind of desolation of the landscape. So that is sort of the image that remained after the 1930s. But before that, Grant Wood was actually depicting it in all its, you know, lushness before any of that stuff began. And I moved to Italy. I moved to Iowa from Italy. Mm. So I remember thinking, wow, I had no idea. And we lived in Bologna where there were rolling hills. And it wasn't until I got on a bike to ride and prepare for Ragbri that I really began to appreciate the rolling hills of Grant Wood's paintings and of Iowa.
Now, I understand you curated the first showing of Grant Wood's work in Washington, D.C. for the Renwood Gallery. When was that?
Yeah, that was, I think that opened about, I arrived here in 2004, so about 2005. It opened at the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art, where I was curator, where people can still go see Grant Wood's historic studio that he lived in from about early 1920s to late 1920s. And we brought it to Washington, D.C. And I can tell you one of the funniest anecdotes was all of the people around the world in the U.S. walking through these Grant Wood scenes, and one man came up to me and he said, "Thank you for bringing the show here. It reminds me so much of my home." And I said, "Really? Where are you from in Iowa?" He said, "Oh, I'm from New Jersey." So you know, I had thought New Jersey was all industry, and lo and behold, it also has a very lush, I mean, that sounds obvious, but it just shows you, until you sometimes go to a place, you don't know what's there. And I think that's the big takeaway for Grant Wood's paintings about being sort of the greatest booster, a postcard for the state of Iowa, is that it defies, you know, what our perceptions are from not seeing a place and how you have to dig into what's really there.
Keith tweets us in our five-word challenge, flat. Oh, Keith, you weren't supposed to use that word. Green, windy expanses. Having just moved here from Pittsburgh, writes Keith, I am pretty confident that it's pretty flat. Well, in answer to that, we have a tweet that says, flat in Iowa applies mostly to easily excavated interstates. Try riding flat Iowa on a bicycle.
Indeed.
And you have done that, Jane.
That's true.
On Ragbri.
Right. And then when I was trying to figure out the origin, of course, with the Mississippi River and the Mississippi River and the glaciers, and you get on that bike and you realize that, I've ridden my bike in Pennsylvania, so he can come try Iowa. It's not as easy as people think. In fact, I should add that Grant Wood was such a booster for the state that Stone City painting and that very beautiful rolling hill location, actually cliffs, you know, there were former quarries, limestone quarries there. So our Pennsylvania person can relate to those quarries. He founded a Stone City art colony in the 1930s, and over 100 students came, and many of those came to be some of the big WPA painters and muralists who worked during the 30s. So they went on to depict Iowa rolling. And another artist, maybe not so well known, I'd like to mention is Marvin Cohn from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, who was Grant Wood's closest friend. And his paintings also depict not only the rolling hills of Iowa, but the luscious skies and clouds. So anyone wants to see what Iowa looks like, there are plenty of paintings there to be had at the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art and Dubuque.
So it seems like in the world of painting, Iowa gets a pretty fair shake compared to other mediums where we're known as flat cornland, right? Our artists are looking for interesting landscapes, and when you look at the rolling hills, that's what you find.
Right. Well, what's interesting is, having been a curator in Iowa, how many contemporary artists are inspired by the landscape when they discover it? Most coming from somewhere else, and then they're enamored with it. They either pick up on the vegetation of Iowa, whether it be the corn, whether it be the grass, the prairie grasses, or the landscape. So I can say one Iowa artist, Ellen Wagner, still contemporary, has I think she has a show coming up at Iowa State, now lives in Arizona, and she still paints Iowa. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how many people buy her works who aren't from Iowa but want to go to Iowa after they see them.
Here are five words that describe Iowa's landscape from one of our listeners. Looks like home to me. Love that one. Elena from Dubuque emails us, landscape reminiscent of European heritage. Groups settled here because Iowa reminded them of the home country. And that's certainly reflected in art, isn't it, Jane?
That's true. And Grant wouldn't, you know, he traveled in Europe in some very hilly areas. He was in Munich, and he was outside of Paris, and he was in Italy. And I think when he came back, he was there in the 20s, in 1930, when he came back and decided he would paint Iowa. He took some of those things that he had seen in Europe and imbued them with the Iowa landscape. So he was very aware of that tradition. So whoever wrote that tweet was right on.
Jane Milosh with us, along with Anna Hadjik. And also Greg Borzo joins us, a native of Iowa, living in Chicago now. Hi, Greg.
Good morning.
Good afternoon. We're just into the afternoon hours. Greg, you've ridden Ragbri how many times?
Three times completely.
And you are the author of a book on Ragbri, America's Favorite Bicycle Ride, Ragbri.
Yes, that's right. And if you want to really know and experience those hills, you got to bike them. I think Jane made that point already. Going up and down those hills on a bike, you appreciate the landscape much more.
Oh, yes. I rode Ragbri the last 2 years, and this year coming into Guttenberg, nobody can say Iowa's flat, especially after you pedal up a hill that is longer than a half mile long, can you, Greg?
Yes, that's right. And going down, I think, is even more of an intense experience because you can get up to 30, 35 miles an hour, and you really feel the speed and appreciate the hill even more. It's even more memorable, the downhill ride.
Mm-hmm. You talked to a lot of people for this book. Did you find some misconceptions, some myths about Iowa's landscape being busted?
Oh, all the time. Yep. People would just say, you know, they weren't prepared for the hills. They were just so surprised by the hills. They were surprised by the beauty of the scenery, too. But all along the way, people on Ragbri, who may be from out of state or even some people from Iowa itself, would be grumbling about the hills. And it is really hilly. Many years, Ragbri has more feet of elevation in its climbing than the famous bike ride out in Colorado called Ride the Rockies.
Hmm.
Because in Iowa, it's up and down, up and down, up and down all day, whereas on Ride the Rockies, you have a steep climb and you go down, and you're pretty much done for the day.
Why do you think ragbri has become the phenomenon that it has in the last few decades, since the early 70s?
Well, really one word, welcoming, the welcoming nature of Iowa, the communities that roll out the red carpet with food and drink and brass bands and flag waving and cheering. That's really what's made this ride into the success that it is. Other factors are important, too. The fact that it's a different route every year, and so you get to engage the entire state, and also the riders get a new treat every year, a new treat of different scenery and more ethnic communities, and they get to visit more beautiful college campuses and movie sites, etc. So having a different route every year is a big, big factor. Other states have similar rides, and they often follow the very same route every year, and it gets a little boring after a couple of years.
Right, right. You see some variety, and it's amazing. I'm sure, Greg, you found this too, that some people are so dedicated to this ride that they will ride it every year for longer than a decade or two decades, won't they?
Well, the ride's been going on 42 years, and there are a handful of people who've done it all 42 years. So the dedication, the addictive power of this ride is pretty phenomenal. I interviewed one lady for my book who at the time was 27, and she had done 29 ragbris. Well, her mom was pregnant for the first one. The second one, they had her on a little backpack, and she wasn't even a year old. So then throughout her life, she did the ride every single year and has chalked up 29 of these, even though she's 27 years old.
Mm-hmm. I want to go to Anna Hadjik. At the University of Wisconsin in Whitewater. We haven't talked with you about ragbri. Does that fit into your thinking about the Midwest and nostalgia as well? It's a 42-year tradition.
Yeah, you know, I think certainly. You know, the ragbri is, you know, something that I think can, it's a way to, it somewhat acts as a sort of unifying event for the state, you know, the ride across Iowa. And, you know, I think, you know, that the word welcoming, you know, I think that that is a fantastic way to describe this event and how it can act both as an event to certainly to have Iowa residents take pride in their state, but also as an kind of an external sort of symbol of you know, of the state's identity as well. You know, ragbri, you know, it usually is either east to west or up and down. It truly does sort of involve the whole state, you know, whenever it happens. And I think they also, just the fact that you're riding on your bicycle, right?
Yeah.
You know, it makes one sort of stop and take stock, and kind of feeds into the sort of idea of the anti-modern as well.
Oh, I see.
Know,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and totally in, like, the total opposite of, let's say, I-80, right, that is, you know, all about, you know, people trying to get through the state as quickly as possible, you know.
Right. I-80 and an interstate is meant to be flat, isn't it?
Mm-hmm, exactly. Right,
and
yeah.
Ragbri is meant to show you a variety and goes through a different route each year. And I like your point about it breaking, breaking the what can be monotony of daily living, so that you have a week where you can even leave your technology at home, though a lot of people don't, do they?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Last question for you, Anna. When you look at, since you've studied popular culture in Iowa, when you look at references to Iowa in TV, in books, in movies, when someone makes a character come from Iowa, what are they usually trying to say?
You know, I think part of it is kind of that innocence, a little bit, you know, that if a character's from Iowa, they have a sort of an innocence, a wide-eyed optimism, you know, is another way to...
Radar O'Reilly.
Yeah, exactly. That would be a... I just saw watched an episode of MASH last night, actually. Yeah.
Okay.
That would be a perfect example of that, yes. And, you know, and I just keep thinking of, you know, The Music Man is always, and always seems to be always in my mind, and you know, you have the sort of our protagonist, he's Harold Hill. He's from outside of Iowa, right? And then he's reformed by Marion Peru, the librarian, who is, you know, that sort of the very epitome of, you know, kind of virtue.
Okay.
Anna,
it's been a joy to have you with us, a lecturer in the English department at the University of Wisconsin in Whitewater. Sorry we have to go. Nice to have you, though, Anna, along with Jane Milosh and Greg Borzo. Thank you for joining in our discussion this half hour.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Charity Nebbe joins me in the studio now. We have a whole week stretching out in front of us of Iowa Week, the unexpected. Tell us what's coming up on Talk of Iowa.
Well, tomorrow we're going to talk about sort of our unexpected literary pedigree in the state, so that should be a lot of fun. And we're going to talk about music on Wednesday. We're going to talk about unexpected horticulture on Friday. All kinds of unexpected and exciting things coming up on both shows this week.
That's right. Tomorrow we're going to talk about Iowa's unexpected testing history on this program. And we're going to waltz out a little bit with Greg Brown. Our waltzing landscape. That's a way to describe it. Thanks, Charity. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio.
Midst of the corn, the middle of the USA. Yeah.